Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the Pop-Up Chinese Studios here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me as usual is Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Dangley.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Hi, Kaiser.
Today, Jeremy and I are celebrating the second anniversary of Seneca, which launched in early April of 2010. In this, our third year of operation, we're going to be bringing you more great guests and timely topics, so make sure to come like us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/SenecaPodcast and join the conversation there, or follow us on Twitter at SenecaPodcast. This week, we're joined by two old friends. We've got Will Moss, the blogger behind the always excellent Image Thief, and now a part of the great new group blog that Jeremy plugged last time, Rectified.name. Great to see you, Will.
Good to be back, Kaiser.
For those of you who haven't read it already, make sure to see his very funny piece inspired by the non-apology rendered by Mr. Mike Daisy, who was, of course, on our last show, or talked about on our last show. I apologize if you felt that you were killed.
Apologize if anybody felt killed.
If anybody felt killed. That's
right. I felt a little killed.
I felt completely slain by that.
I'm glad you're sorry about it.
Yeah. I am.
I was utterly slain by that. That was really good. Also joining us is China veteran David Wolf, president of Wolf Group Asia, which consults on strategy and communications. David, welcome back to Seneca.
Hi, Kaiser. Good to be back.
Today, we'll be looking at the Chinese government's crackdown on rumors, most recently with the shutdown of 16 websites and the announcement of a three-day hiatus on comments on China's two leading microblog services, Sina's Weibo and Tencent's T.QQ.com. We'll then talk about the changing job market for expatriates in China. Is the fabled fat expat package now a thing of the past? How high has the bar for foreigners seeking gainful employment here actually gotten? And all of that stuff. Anyway, let's jump right in and begin by talking about rumors. Over the weekend, and really to no one's real surprise, the State Internet Information Office issued an order which was picked up by Xinhua, which called for the shutdown of 16 internet sites in China for spreading rumors related to the non-events of March 19th. It was also announced that Sina and Tencent, which operate very popular microblog or Weibo services, boasting what 300 million each, I think.
So they say,
yeah, right. They would be forced to shut down comments for a 72-hour period, rendering them painfully like Twitter.
But still better.
But still better.
Touché.
And the check is coming to you from Sina right now. Okay.
And I want my check from Tencent too, actually.
Jeremy, give us some background on this. Okay, so this wasn't the first effort to rein in microblogging, now was it?
No, this has been developing for a long time. It's been developing really since the very beginning of microblogging, when the first microblogs in China were all shut down in 2009 before Sina even started the service.
Right, Fanfo and DUI.
That's right. Around the time of the Xinjiang ethnic unrest, or whatever you like to call that,
riots,
July of 2009 riots. The first microblogging services were all shut down, and Sina launched shortly after that. And ever since its beginning, there have been worries in the media and on the part of government officials about it going out of control. After the Wenzhou train crash last year, there has been a growing group of voices in the government that has been calling on various restrictions. And up till now, the most talked about one has been real name registration requirements for
and
users.
We'll get to that in a little bit about real name registration. And
well, let's get to it now. I mean,
sure,
basically,
sure, no,
there was a deadline, supposedly.
March 16th,
which may or may not have applied to all microblogging services, but in the media was mostly talked about as applying to Sina. They sort of complied. They've kind of made most of their users somehow use a cell phone or some way of registering their real identities, but they haven't done it very strictly.
It seems like a very porous system.
Yeah,
very porous indeed.
What have our personal experiences been in terms of registering? I mean, did you actually go ahead and register? Are you still able to post?
No, but somebody verified me way, way back on Sina.
Right, I tied mine to a phone number.
And I have my phone. It's tied to my mobile phone. So, I mean, they know who I am anyway. So
I was verified from very early because we use it for work in my company. But a friend of mine told me last week that he and his wife still have an account tweeting in their dog's name. And so far, they're not having any problems with that. So make of that what you will.
Okay. What do we make of this whole comet freeze? Was this a shot across the bow? I think, Jeremy, you actually used that phrase in an interview, didn't you?
I did use that phrase. Not the first time I've used that phrase about internet-sensitive in China, actually, I realize. But I think it was a shot across the bow from the government telling the internet companies and the internet users that, you know, be careful. Don't talk about coups that haven't happened. Don't talk about things we don't want you talking about.
But, I mean, to me, it seemed like an awfully light punishment. I mean, David, did that strike you as?
It did strike me as light, and that's what caused me to pause. And what I think this really was this was a test of the emergency non-broadcast system, if you will. I mean, this was the government's opportunity to prove to itself and to the industry that if we wanted to, we could twist the knob and everything would shut off. They always knew conceptually that they could do it, but they wanted to see, I think, how precisely can we do it? Can we do it for a 72-hour period, and can we dig down into the actual service itself to turn off a feature? I think now that they've done this, it's not only given them that degree of comfort. I also think we have to remember that we're not dealing with a government that's a monolith here. I think there are people inside the government who see the value of Weibo and of QQ's competing service, and I think that there are those who don't, and for those who don't, this was a proof point saying, yes, look, we do actually have this control.
Do you think that it's possible that they were actually receiving contradictory or different instructions from within the leadership?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, my first feeling was, why just 72 hours? Was this, you know, one guy woke up one day and said, ooh, we're going to shut this down, and then 3 days later somebody said, let's turn it back on again. I think it was more
without any inside knowledge. I mean, it smelled to me like a negotiated settlement. It felt like they sat down with the GR departments of both of these and said, listen, here's what we'd like to do. We're going to need to give you a wrist slap, but maybe let's time it for the holiday, for the Qingming Festival, which was, I thought, suspicious. And then let's just make it, you know, a ban on a piece of the service. I mean, I thought that, you know, allowing them to continue to retweet things or to repost to Zhuanfa, I mean, that's the main piece of the service. I mean, of course, in addition to writing original posts.
Well, that's the propagation side of the service.
Right.
Which is really strange. So if you really want to throttle it, that would be the part you would turn off.
Yeah.
And people very, very, very quickly, as in within 3 minutes, figured out that you could basically
circumvent,
make a comment thread by looking at the forwarding thread. So
kind of like what we do with Twitter.
But yeah, just slightly better.
What they did do, as Jeremiah Jenny pointed out on rectified.name, was that they relit the story again by doing that. You know, we were a week past the rumors, things had died down, and they did reintroduce it as a topic by implementing this shutdown. All of a sudden, everybody was talking about it.
And people who hadn't heard of this rumored coup suddenly had heard of it. So
yeah, but this time, I mean, I think that there was nobody who believed that this might possibly be true. Now, did you guys get a chance to read what Gotti wrote in The Economist this afternoon? I mean, I think he just filed it this afternoon, just hours before.
I did, and I wish I could remember it well enough, because it's the only report I've seen that has actually done the reporting on how the coup rumors started and what happened in those basically 24 hours, I guess, when the whole thing got going.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that people check that out.
I have it in front of me. So it's called The Anatomy of a Coup Rumor, and it's on the Analex blog.
And he was a little bit regretful not have having you know, invoked the point. He should have called it Chinese Whispers, of course.
But he traced the flow of the tweets and how they kind of snowballed and accreted on one another to create this rumor. It's very interesting, and it's worth reading.
Yeah, it's a really important piece to read. Let's talk a little bit about this. This is a question that I put on our Facebook page, and I got some interesting answers on it. Why were Tencent, and especially Sina, willing to dance so close to the flames here? I mean, their systems, was it a possibility that their systems, either in terms of manpower or their automated filtration systems, got overwhelmed by this? Or was this like a deliberate choice, a calculated risk? I mean, deliberately dancing close to the fire, knowing that, you know, it's kind of these politically hot topics that generate a lot of user interest and a lot of traffic. Did you get a sense for this? What emboldened them to move so close?
I think there's a couple of things. I think there's this implicit belief in both camps that they actually work very closely with the government, and that there is somebody in the government who's watching and will tap the shoulder when things get out of hand. So they do feel emboldened to go and do the commercial thing. But then something very interesting happened today. I don't know if you guys were seeing this, but on Weibo, they were actually having some discussion about one of the aspects of the Tiananmen Square incident.
Oh, no, the 1976 Tiananmen Square incident.
1976 Tiananmen Square incident, sorry. But, I mean, you know, anything that's going to be mentioning, you know, peripherally. But, you know, Bill Bishop was commenting. He was saying, well, I wonder how long before this gets shut off. And it actually went on most of the day.
Right. Well, I mean, ordinarily, I mean, that isn't something that's taboo. You can talk about that. Just for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, in April of 1976, this is actually the anniversary date of that. There was a funeral mourning session for Premier Zhou Enlai, who was, of course, much loved. It was regarded as sort of the first Tiananmen incident, and it was not, you know, very, very violently suppressed, but the protesters were eventually pushed out. So let me get back to my question here. I mean, why did authorities wait as long as they did then? I mean, quite a bit of time elapsed between the day the rumors spread on the 19th and the day they finally put their foot down, which was, you know, close to, what, 12 days later?
I think it wasn't as clear as it seems in retrospect what was going on even just on Weibo, because over the course of starting from the Wang Lijun affair, and over the course of the National People's Congress, there have been tweets where people have said, you know, Chu Da Shirla, something big has happened. And there have been various people with followings who've said things that, you know, indicates a level of political uncertainty or are connected with the possible intrigues behind the Bo Xilai affair. And they haven't been using keywords that are on the keyword filters. So I don't think it's been that easy. You know, in the early days, it wasn't that easy to actually say that something was going on.
I think it's a really important point. This stuff moves amazingly fast at incredibly high volumes, aggregated millions upon millions of individual tweets. And there's an enormous gray area between stuff that's obviously safe and inoffensive and stuff that's obviously politically risky or courting censorship. And we all know from having observed the system that there is no sort of hard and fast line, that different aspects, different safeties trip at different times, the internal ones and the external ones. And I think that's right. I think it's easy to look back from what Jeremy was saying and say, well, this was obviously a crock. I think when things are unfolding, it's a lot harder. And it's a lot – you know, with Gatti – this is why it's worth reading Gatti's post. Some of the stuff that started the ball rolling here was originally inoffensive, not related to any allegations of a coup. It's when it started aggregating
saying,
together.
Why are there all these military or police right. gathered at
well,
the
so what? That happens sometimes. Yeah.
But see, this is the thing. I think it's three reasons. I think it's – the first is the government doesn't move that fast. All right? This is a party and a government that is just ridden with inertia, especially at this point when they don't have a great deal of consensus driving the government. I mean, you've got very clear divisions within the party right now that are going to slow decision-making and are going to slow action. That's the
yeah,
first
thing. Yeah, that's what I was getting at, really.
Yeah. And then there's a second aspect to it, which you've mentioned and which Gatti, I think, really points out, and that this was an awful lot of innuendo. You know, there were pointers, but they were vague pointers. Nobody was standing up and saying, there's a coup taking place. You know, it was – people were gradually putting things together. But I think the third thing that sort of pushed this over the edge was the coverage it was getting overseas. It got a lot of coverage overseas, and people were saying, "Oh, look at all the rumors about a coup in Beijing." And it was when the media offshore began to put those numbers together that it really became something that the government was compelled to respond to.
I mean,
to.
In this case, it's not the Western media that we're talking about. The Western media was pretty responsible about this. They were calling it what it was, but there were certain other and mostly Chinese language media properties outside of China. No, the what they call the Jinghua media, and what they mean here is things like New Tang Dynasty Television,
Falun Gong operations,
yeah, Falun Gong,
yeah, with made up or hyped up details. But it did get some play. I mean, the FT had a piece on it, and there was another
major
paper.
That was a few days later, though. Right.
So it was picked up eventually by, you know, very respectable Western media, even reported as a rumor, but still.
So there's a good point. A good point was made by Christina Larson in Foreign Policy writing about this stuff, which is one of the things that exacerbated this, is that there's no trusted channel from the government by which to address this stuff when it starts unfolding.
Right. I mean, this is brought up every time. I mean, and not just by foreign reporters, but I mean, this is what the Chinese, a lot of Chinese netizens were saying too. It's like, you know, hey, you want you know the way to address rumors, the way to deal with them, to nip them in the bud, is to have an official channel that
and to have transparency. I mean, Jiang Xin famously said, tweeted that on Weibo, that if there's no transparency, you can't stop rumors.
That's right.
So, and that's right. And they don't have transparency. So if you don't have that, you're left with corrective action after the fact and everybody continuing to guess. And this is going to happen again.
But the corrective action, let me get back to this again. It seemed incredibly light to me. 16 websites shut down. I would venture to say that not a single cynical listener has heard of one of these websites. But I mean, what were these websites that were shut down, Jeremy?
xdndvry.3.com.
They're for all my stuff.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was just really
bizarre. I've never heard of any of them. They're very strange. I spend an unhealthy amount of time on
the Chinese. But those shutdowns of websites happen all the time, the sort of purging of unsavory websites. And I think that's much less significant than taking action directly against the microblogs.
Right, of course.
But I also think that there's another element here, and that is that the government doesn't want to be too heavy with its hand in these corrective actions. I mean, I think it was Dan Minter that pointed out that
– Adam Minter?
Yeah. Adam Minter that pointed out that at some point a line had been crossed when they cut the comments off, and you started to get people who were completely politically unaware – who were using the service, who started getting upset. And at that point, you begin to see, you know, the dictator's dilemma. You're squeezing so tight that people who you wouldn't normally upset are getting upset by the process. And so, you know, do you want to be – if you want to kill a chicken to scare a monkey, right? Or do you want to kill a big one? You want to kill something that's really going to upset people that they lose it? Or you just want to grab something that's completely worthless and say, look, I can do this to this guy. I can sure as heck do it to you.
Right.
You know, and so I think it was to avoid – any form of general backlash that they went after these specific sites.
Kai-Fu Lee showed that he had a pretty good sense of humor in responding to this. He put a joke up on Weibo, which went something like, reporter asks government official, what are you going to do in response to rumors that are being spread on Weibo and on Tencent Weibo? And he said, no comment.
I have to say that one of the things I've enjoyed in the last couple of weeks watching Weibo is that from about the end of the Olympics until about the beginning of this year, I've been quite depressed about China generally. It's felt like the intellectual environment, the media environment, has been constricting and getting more and more boring. But the last few months have been really quite wonderful. What you see on Weibo today, it really is remarkable. I mean, can you imagine 5 years ago, people like Pan Shiyi, people who have a lot to lose, you know, kind of crossing what used to be considered a red line to discuss things ranging from pollution to, you know, censorship on the internet. People like Kai-Fu Lee has also got a lot to lose, willing to make jokes like that. This is a new thing, and it's quite wonderful, I think.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that this is one of these quintessential it's one of these basic contradictions here that we deal with all the time, is that even as restrictions have ratcheted up pronouncedly in the last 4 years, really since 2008, we've seen this public sphere emerge in Chinese life at the same time on the social media sites. And in many ways, these same netizens are more politically potent than they were prior to that. I mean, in spite of these increasing pressures from the government. Let me throw one thing out here. One person who's quite intelligent, who has had quite a bit of experience running social media here in China, suggested to me that this may have been something that Sina and Tencent did or agreed to because they knew that they have a lot of moderators going on holiday. A lot of their people were going to be taking off, and they knew that they were going to be overwhelmed, that BBSs in the old day would often shut down or severely curtail their services in advance of either holidays or sensitive dates when they knew that traffic was going to be kind of overwhelming, so that his suggestion is that then this was probably something that was kind of offered up. It was like, why don't we do this as punishment? Does that sound plausible to you? It really has the ring of – I mean, I know how these things
work. It sounds plausible.
This is China. If it's not true, it should be.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it sounds plausible. Who knows other than, you know, the people inside the Sina and Tencent and the government. I have no trouble believing that it was a negotiated solution. It surely played no role in controlling the actual discourse because it was too late and it was too temporary. So I have no trouble believing that. Who knows if it's true, but it feels like a negotiated settlement, and I'm sure that there was some back and forth until it was acceptable to all sides.
I mean, and here we are on the other side of it. Do you feel like anyone has been really dissuaded from engaging in that kind of rumor spreading activity anymore?
Not a chance.
Yeah. No. I don't think so, right. Anyway, I think we've played that one out. Let's move on and talk about our next topic, which is the changing job market for expatriates in China. Some months ago, you guys may recall, there was a young man by the name of – what's his name? Jonathan Levine?
Jonathan Levine.
Right. A graduate of NYU in Columbia. He wrote an op-ed piece called Go East, Young Man, in the Times, in the New York Times. And he set something of a firestorm off with this suggestion that the job market being in the U.S. And all, people ought to really consider – coming to China. And he goes on to talk about the world of opportunity that's opened up to him upon arrival here. There were a lot of people who really, you know, took the guy to task for it, other people who agreed pretty heartily with him. Just last week, though, we saw another very different take. There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal titled Asia's Endangered Species, the Expat, in which it's argued that there's a clear preference in the professional and managerial positions anyway, for people who were born in Asia, went abroad for their education, have now returned to this part of the world, and that opportunities for people without much Asia experience, or for our purposes, China experience, are kind of disappearing. They're no longer really sought after. Can we reconcile these two perspectives by simply saying that, well, there are a lot of jobs out here for people if they're willing to teach ESL or work as a freelancer for, you know, an expatriate magazine? None of us here have ever done that right now.
We're sort of a weird sample to be having this discussion because we are all poster children for building careers in China.
That's right.
Yeah, that's part of the reason I asked you all here. All four of us who have sort of built careers here in China. Are we a vestige of a bygone era now? I mean,
both of those articles are right. You can reconcile the two. I don't think coming to China to be an English teacher is necessarily a springboard to a fabulous career. Perhaps it can be. I think that's one reason why Jonathan Levine's article came in for some knocks when it first got shared around the internet here. But I don't think there's any reason why young people interested in Asia or interested in China shouldn't come here and look to build a career. I don't think it's necessarily an easy thing to do. I think you can come here and find a job. I think it's harder to come here and build a career. That is not irreconcilable with the fact that expats, particularly the expat deal, is a vanishing thing. That's definitely true. In 16 years and change in Asia, I personally have had a grand total of 14 months on a very low rent expat deal. And the rest of the time I've been a local hire.
Wow.
And I think that's the wave of the future, even for foreigners out here. Expatriates, true expatriates, the kind of people who get a full ride, are ferociously expensive. And for any foreigner working abroad, not just in China but anywhere, the math is always what is the value of this person against the cost of having a local in that position. And a full expat ride turbocharges that equation as far as expense goes.
David, what's a full expat ride go?
Full expat ride, typically you're only going to be giving it to a relatively senior executive. So that's an individual who in the United States would be taking home anywhere from about $250,000 a year on up in base salary. So a full expat package here.
That's what they call the working poor now.
That's what they call the working poor.
But once upon a time.
Once upon a time. So, you know, if you figure that's a quarter of $1 million a year, it's $20,000 a month in a salary. You've got another $25,000 to $30,000 a year in school fees if they've got per child.
Right.
Okay, I know one family. The husband's a banker. He's an overseas Chinese. He's got five kids, every single one of them in an international school. So it's $125,000 a year just for the kids' schooling.
My Lord.
On top of that, you have international health care packages, which through companies like Cigna, which run extremely expensive to the point where most MNCs won't pay for them anymore except for the most senior people. And they send the whole family home twice a year, business class, on international airlines.
Plus housing.
Plus housing.
Plus sometimes a tax equalization package.
Plus a tax equalization. So for somebody who's making $250,000 a year, the whole package.
We're talking an easy $2 million then.
We're talking at least $500,000 on the budget plan. You could be talking as much as $2 million by the time all the costs are figured in for the company.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what you're comparing against a possible local or attorney alternative now.
And so what's the more realistic option right now? I mean, what is somebody who's going to come here with a liberal arts degree, a few years of Mandarin under the belt, you know, let's even call it fluency, you know, who's, what, 26 years old, has just finished a master's degree in East Asian studies and has come out here, or maybe he has an MBA even. What are they looking at? What are the job prospects out here for them?
I think, and others can speak from their experience. From mine, it varies a great deal for the individual. There was no formula for who as a foreigner was going to stick here. And I've interviewed and hired a lot of foreigners here over the years, particularly when I was in an agency. There were really two kinds of foreigners that we would hire for agency work here in China. One was the junior hire, a really young person, and basically hired for their native English skills, their writing skills, and their ability to get materials ready for foreign clients. Mm-hmm. And the other people that got hired were experienced people, middle senior and up, who had a specialized skill set that we needed.
Sort of director level.
Yeah, or manager level at least. And that's how I came in. I came in because I had my Chinese at the time certainly wasn't very good. It's not that good now, and that was 8 years ago. So I stuck because I had a particular skill set that was broadly applicable. And those were the other people who got hired. And everybody who was a foreigner that we hired, essentially everybody with rare exceptions, was somebody who was clearly already committed to the market in some way. The junior hires had done exchange programs. They were already living here. They were coming out of Hopkins, Nanjing, or programs like that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so much the language skill as proving that they really were interested in being here. Nobody was hired and brought in from overseas. That just doesn't happen anymore.
Not at those levels. Maybe no. At the most senior levels.
At the most senior levels, that's the expat package.
Right,
though.
Right.
And if you're not at that level, then you got to be here.
And so, that's not for people interested in China. That's for people who are very senior in a corporation and get transferred, right?
Right.
That's right.
Yes. And you're either here for specific skills or because their tickets need to be punched before going to a higher level.
Let's turn to Jeremy here. I mean, you are in many ways sort of a prototypical case. You came here in your 20s as an English teacher. You learned the language well. You did work at the expat magazines for a number of them, in fact.
I started half of them. What do you mean?
Yeah. But you've clung very tenaciously to this, I mean, to your independence. I mean, I know for a fact that you've had many an offer come by, you know, to try to pull you into the corporate world. What's that been like for you? I mean, watching the scene change here.
Well, I think Beijing, at least, let me not speak of China, but certainly Beijing, remains a great place if you have ideas and energy and you want to just do them. Because this city, if you have an idea and a tiny little bit of money and some energy, you can make stuff happen. You know, you can rent an office in 2 days. You can move an entire warehouse full of goods across the city with 1 day's notice. Right. You can call up people and say, I've got this thing. Are you interested? And maybe they are. It still remains a place of great opportunity for somebody who wants to bootstrap.
Set up a little recording studio, throw some mics in a room, and start a podcast.
Yeah.
Apropos of nothing whatsoever. Yes.
And I don't think, you know, it's got a little bit more difficult because Beijing used to be a city where it lacked so many basic services needed for a modern city, you know, from recording studios to people who knew what advertising was to, you know, people who could design a newsletter properly. It's no longer the case that there are not those gaps in the market.
Yeah, I mean,
but there are still a lot of gaps.
The gravity on this planet has changed, right? Yeah, I mean, when we came here, it was a low-gravity planet. I know that was the case with me, whether I'm talking about my guitar playing or anything. I mean, it used to be sort of I could leap – tall buildings in a single bound. And
right.
Now
we knew everybody who was in the rock scene in Beijing.
Right. We
at
did.
One time,
we knew everyone.
You know,
right.
Whereas now that's not possible.
Absolutely not.
I mean, right. I remember knowing pretty much where every single output center in Beijing was. That was when I was doing the Beijing Scene magazine. So this was back in the day when you took your, you know, old Mac, which was still beige. And,
Stone Age.
You stayed up all night, and then you came out with color transparencies, four of them, and then you went to the print. You know, you went to an output place to make the color transparencies, and then you had to deliver them to a printer. There used to be only about 10 in the whole city. So
part of that center of gravity change now, though, for foreigners who want to get established here, is that there is now also a large, established, experienced foreign community that spans many levels of experience and seniority entrenched here in the city. It's a pretty large community.
But it's not really them that we're competing against. I mean, who we're competing against are those kids that left China to go to high school and college in the United States. They came back to China after, you know, with an MBA in hand from Kellogg or from Wharton, who still speak absolutely flawless Chinese and perfectly good English, who have actual skills, who have worked in companies, who worked on Wall Street, worked in the Valley, worked, you know, in
well, we're lucky. We're not competing with those people. It's people who want to arrive now who are competing with them. And I think that is a tough cohort to compete with.
That's right. I mean, and they are coming back. I mean, there are opportunities here, and they're coming. I meet them all the time, and they're amazing. They're truly amazing. I mean,
speaking Chinese, I think, has become a nice little smiley face on your resume as a foreigner, but it's by no means a ticket to anything, whereas it used to actually be.
Right,
you could get
really
a lot of jobs just if you spoke English and Chinese.
Right. And now, I mean, are you locked out of almost everything if you don't? Is that the case now?
I don't know.
I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I do think it depends a great deal on what else you offer.
Right.
You have to you may not be being hired for your Chinese skills. And you know, I told my boss when she hired me back in 2004, I said, I don't speak very good Chinese. My boss was Chinese. She said, I'm not hiring you for your Chinese. I got 70 Chinese people who speak Chinese, you know. Yeah. But you have to have something else that you're bringing that makes up for that. Chinese is useful. It helps. It's part of what shows your interest and commitment to the market. But if you have something else, it may not be essential.
And what was that in your case?
A sense of humor,
right.
Good fashion sense.
Yeah,
no, technology PR. I've done a lot of technology
right,
PR.
Right, right, right. I mean, it actually strikes me that three of us sitting here in this room right now are or were or still, you know, really, we still are. We're very much engaged in PR. Will, you are. I certainly am. David, you've been in PR pretty much your whole career here, right?
More, I mean, one part of PR or another, yeah.
Right. David was one of the people who participated in my hiring back then, 2004, just to share the incestuousness.
So you can blame me, China.
So it's true. We are all looking out for each other.
So
that what you will.
Let's look at this. I mean, is PR – I mean, an astonishing number of the – longer-term expats here in their 40s that I know are in this business.
That may just be the people you're hanging out with.
Well, no, I think there's something.
You think that I would seek them out, PR people?
Here we are.
It's not just PR. I think it's the marketing professions.
Right.
I think it's law. You know, you've got guys like
Stan Abrams.
Yeah, and folks like that.
Professional services.
Professional
consulting
services
as well.
And I think one of the reasons.
Research.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons for that, if you look at every single one of these different professions, there is an element in there where the foreigner still brings a few things of great value. One, they bring a dedication to quality, an understanding of what quality is. And most of us, I would say, don't like to take shortcuts. We know when something is good. We know when something is bad, and we're going to stick with it. And, you know, sometimes when you're running an organization here, sometimes that's enough. Sometimes
but
that's,
David,
that's
I think
value.
I think you're right, but I think it's a very particular aspect of quality, because I think when it comes to manufacturing a widget, Chinese people, there's no longer really a difference. I mean, when it comes to communicating a message or writing a report that is supposed to inform an executive or shaping a concept in words, I think there's still a big gap there.
I could debate that, having spent a little time in widget factories here. And, you know, simply because the challenge with factory, whether you're in whether challenge with quality, whether you're in a factory or whether you were in an office, is trust but verify. Trust your people to do the best possible quality. Trust the people on the line at Foxconn or one of those other thousands and thousands of companies down in Guangzhou to do the right thing. But make sure you're there to make sure that it's coming out the way you want it.
So I think there's something to the sort of representation of foreigners in professional services. But I do think at the same time, and certainly I've seen this in the time I've been here, that here again, you know, we have been grooming our replacements. There is a cohort now of extremely talented Chinese professionals who have grown up in this environment, who've right. grown up in firms like the ones we used to work for, and have been inculcated in this approach that maybe was something that once upon a time we brought. They now have it.
They do.
And some of them have it in spades, which is great. It's a good thing. But
so not everyone who comes here is interested in working for a big multinational, right? I mean, a lot of them come here with the entrepreneurial bug. What's the landscape in entrepreneurship shaping up like?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's a great country to start a business. It's a country that's almost impossible to successfully run a business. But starting a business, this is a great place to do it. And if you're young and you have entrepreneurial zeal, it's fantastic. But, you know, unfortunately, a lot of young people with entrepreneurial zeal start their businesses here when they still have stars in their eyes and they haven't quite figured out how brutish this market is. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, not necessarily a good thing. But, you know, if you're going to start a business, you have to have an appetite for risk. So
right. But, I mean, there are a couple of examples of people who have done spectacularly well. If Fritz Demopoulos comes to mind.
And they're people who've done fine, you know, people who are not well known but have, you know, had a nice time running a business or still have a nice time running a business, make good money, like what they do. Yeah. I mean, I'm that kind of person. I'm not like a Fritz Demopoulos. I'm just a person who's managed to run my own business for most of my working life.
We keep waiting for you to get rich so you can take us all out for drinks.
That's right.
I mean, you know, in 70 years or so,
well. Well, and I would count myself partly as another product of entrepreneurialism. I mean, I left the agency life, the multinational agency, thinking that I was going to take a year off and spend the time scuba diving. And that lasted 72 hours and because the opportunities are here.
Yeah.
And so I started my business when I had no intention of being an entrepreneur. And here I am 7 years later, still running the darn thing. But I'm with you. I don't want to build it to sell it like Fritz does. I want to build it to run it. I'm a proprietor. And I have relatively modest hopes and dreams for my business. I just want to have a good time doing what I'm doing. And
China is a good place to do that.
It's a great place to do it.
Let's talk briefly about second tier cities and other tier cities. I mean, because you know, most of our working experiences have been in Beijing and Will, I know in your case, Shanghai. I spent a little bit of time there as well. What about the rest of the country? Are there opportunities for young Americans? Are there better opportunities for them?
I don't know that there's better opportunities. I would say that of the many young and China-talented foreigners I've worked with, many of them were distinguished by having spent some time in second- and third-tier cities before they came to Beijing mm-hmm. and having built some of that experience before they came here.
They have that gratitude just for being here.
Well, I think it gave them valuable perspective. It gave them good language skills
right.
because they were in places where they couldn't be sloppy and lazy like me. So I do think that a lot of the really good foreigners I worked with had that experience. But I'm not sure about the opportunities.
I mean, I would advise anybody who was thinking to come to China and thinking that they might want to spend a long time here, definitely go to a small shithole first because you need to understand the kind of life that most people in this country live. If you come to Beijing or Shanghai and
it's like
you
know, the
Apple stores and Starbucks.
Yeah,
and
you're completely misguided. You don't know what's going on in this
it's
country.
It's like the State Department. They want you to go stamp passports in Cameroon for 2 years before you get a decent
And if you can't do that, it's worth getting out from time to time and just right. getting a picture of what the broader China is like. And not, it's valuable.
Not to pull a muscle patting us on our backs, but you know, Jeremy Kaiser and I came here in the 90s, in the early mid-90s, when Beijing was still kind of like that.
Right.
You know, I mean, Beijing was still a hardship post.
It was difficult to get coffee.
Yeah, it was difficult to get, you know, difficult
milk.
To get a
it
sandwich.
Was difficult to get milk.
They're,
yeah.
you know.
Let's go on.
Yeah.
Beef.
Yeah.
Rucola. Rucola. Seriously.
Tabasco sauce.
Being the soft living one in the group, I'm now pleased to say that you can get all the coffee, milk, cheese, and arugula you can possibly eat.
Yes. In multiple locations. and deliver it.
Which amplifies the point. if you're coming here, if you're going east, young man, cut your teeth on a smaller city before you pamper yourself in Beijing or Shanghai.
That's very good advice. And David, you must get asked a lot about, I mean, for advice from young folks. What other words of wisdom might you dispense? And let's go out on this.
I really think that if you're going to show up here, and this sort of builds on what Will said, if you're going to show up here, have a very good idea of where you can add value in the process. Because if you don't, you have no business being here anyway. Don't come here starry-eyed. Don't come here expecting the jobs are in Beijing if they're not in New York. This place will kill you just as quick as anywhere else. I think Jack Perkowski back in the mid-1990s was quoted in The Economist as saying that China is going to be the Vietnam War of American business. It's going to be the end of more promising young careers than any other factor in decades. And I think that's a valid point. You can come over here and get sent home in a body bag just as easily as you can come over here and be successful. The difference is knowing where you add value.
Very good. And with that, let's move on to recommendations. And let's start over here on my right with Will Moss. What you got for us this week, Will?
Well, apropos of 75% of us being PR men, I wanted to point people to an article in the New York Times today by David Barboza. It's called In China, the Best Coverage Cash Can Buy, and it's about media ethics and advertising and advertorial in newspapers in China. I mean, the article is interesting, and the problem it talks about, well, not new, is real.
It's a good piece.
It is a good piece. I wish that it had got more into the greater media context here. I think to kind of understand where media in China is now, you have to look at what the history is and where it's coming from and how its role in society has traditionally been viewed, which has a little nuance that's not there. But these challenges that businesses face in dealing with media and communicating and that the media here and journalists and editors face here are all real, and it's worth reading.
So you think it was too much of a static snapshot that it doesn't show you sort of the backstory? And
I do.
Because things have improved.
Things have improved, and there's also a philosophical difference here between the tradition of how media is looked at in the West as the fourth estate and the tradition of how it's viewed here, which is largely as an entity of government service that is now changing, and that change is being driven largely from within the Chinese media, spurred along to some degree by Weibo and other things. But understanding that puts some helpful context around this story. Nevertheless, an interesting read. It's called In China, the Best Coverage Cash Can Buy by David Barboza. It was published today.
There's a great quote in there from some guy in Shanghai who's talking about how, you know, my company could come up with a cure for cancer, and unless I stuffed red envelopes full of cash, I still couldn't get any Chinese journalists come cover.
Well, he just has to work on his storytelling skills.
Exactly. That's what I think. David, what do you have for us?
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to plug something of my own. So,
good.
Next week, my labor of love for the last three quarters of a year, a book about China's telecommunications industry and how it has grown up and what it is and what it isn't is coming out. It's called Making the Connection, The Peaceful Rise of China's Telecommunications Giants, and that'll be out on Amazon next week.
So you look at ZTE and Huawei?
Look at a few companies that a lot of people haven't heard of because they were supported by the government very early on and died in ignominy. So
what were some of these other guys? Red Sail or
Was a company called Great Dragon, which was started by the son of a PLA general back in 1988. They were going to be the Great White Hope. They were going to be China's champion, and they built the first domestically designed and made digital switch, and the government designated them a champion, got six companies together and mashed into this one company, and 10 years later, they were dead.
So, I mean, how's your book come down on Huawei? I mean, this has, of course, been in the news very much recently because they were blocked from a tender on a big, relatively sensitive project for Australia. Where do you come down on them?
Where I come down on Huawei is this is a company that's been built by a group of entrepreneurs that built it as far away from the emperor as they possibly could be, stayed away from government, and have now built a global enterprise. I mean, 70% of their business this year will be from outside of China, and that's not an accident. That's because they've learned how to play the game better. And read the book to find out more, but Huawei is not the devil that a lot of people would like to
pay. Well, I cannot agree with you more. Jeremy, what do you have for us? Once again, the title.
Making the Connection, Making the Peaceful Connection. Rise of China's Telecommunications Giants.
By David Wolf. It'll be on Kindle right away?
It'll definitely be on Kindle.
Not Peaceful Evolution, huh?
Rise. The Peaceful Rise.
Looking forward. Jeremy.
I have a piece of miscellanea today. I stumbled upon a blog called longhaulchina.com, which is now more or less defunct, but it a student on a Fulbright research grant named Rachel Katz last year spent about half a year hitchhiking on transport on trucks in China, more than 8,000 miles across China. And she has a blog and some other information about her trip on longhaulchina.com. And it's just one of those interesting little insights into a world that you're not normally part of that you can find on the internet.
Rachel, if you're out there, write us a letter, drop us a note, come talk to us. We'd love to hear about your experience.
She does say that she's going to be making a book, Long Haul China, Hitchhiking Diplomacy by Rachel Katz. But there's a nice JPEG of a book cover, but no information about where one could buy it. So
I'm going to do two quick recommendations. One is a blog that I'm embarrassed to say I only recently discovered. It's called Blood and Treasure.
Oh, that's one of the old good ones.
It's old school.
It is old school. We're talking like 2005.
But seriously, I had never really read it before. I mean, it's written by somebody who goes by Jamie Kay. We don't know who he is, but apparently a Brit who's I mean, he's got a lot of
he's funny
issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's very funny.
He's very funny. I mean, he's deeply funny and also very insightful. And I was alerted to this because he had written sort of a riposte to a piece that was written by John Garneau, which was sort of a pain to Wen Jiabao in foreign policy. But anyway, it's a good blog. I've really enjoyed reading it. The other thing that I've got, we'll make sure to put a link to it. It's a Typepad blog, and I don't remember the exact URL. The other thing that I've got is The God of Gamblers, which is Evan Osnos's most recent piece in The New Yorker. It's available, not paywalled, on the site, so you can read it there. It's got everything you could possibly want in a gambling story about Macau. It's got, you know, this barber who goes from rags to fabulous riches, to becoming, you know, this the god of gamblers. It's got the whole decidedly checkered history of the former Portuguese colony of Macau. It's got the triads, of course. They're indispensable to the story. I mean, all these ridiculously flamboyant characters from Stanley Ho to Sheldon Adelson, the guy who gave like $16.5 million to Newt Gingrich's super PAC. Elaborate sting operations to catch the gangsters. It's got it all. It's a great story, and I highly recommend it. And with that, I bid you all adieu. Will, thanks for coming. Good to see you again.
A pleasure. Nice to be back.
David, thanks as always. Again, it's been good to see you. And Jeremy. And
have a great evening, Kaiser.
Yeah, and all hail the azure-winged magpie. We will talk to you guys next week on the Seneca Podcast. All hail.
All hail.